Hello, and welcome to The Trumpet, the official podcast of Elephant Room Productions. As always, I am your host, Robert Jean Pelleccio. Joining me this month, we have David Kalish. Thank you so much for coming on and talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really, really excited to talk about this play because it is very funny and is my... That's kind of my roadhouse to talk about funny plays. And it's got a lot of heart to it too, and I know sometimes that's a little bit of a difficult balance to have heart and humor that don't kind of conflict with each other. But before we go into that, would you mind cluing us in a little bit about your theater background?
Sure. Well, I've always written, as long as I can remember. I wrote my first poem in kindergarten. I was a journalist for many years at Associated Press in New York City. But I had the opportunity a while back to focus on my creative writing. And I had my first novel out, my only novel out, about 4 years ago. And it actually provided the source material for this play.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was an interesting exercise for me, basically going back into the novel and trying to figure out which part of it would work as a play and then translating a lot of it to dialogue.
Is this the opposite of everything?
Yes, it's got the same title, and it's on Amazon. I like the stretching into different formats generally. I've written lots of essays. I actually had an essay in the New York Times in the Modern Love section, which went into the exact same events that I do depict in the play. So I like stretching. I went from novel to essay and now to play. And every time I get into a new format, I discover something else about the writing. And it's a lot of work because you need to be aware, like, you know, dialogue does a lot more things in a play than in a novel. You can't really have too much narrative.
Well, so, I'm looking at your bio on your website right now, all of your plays, and it's your publications, and it's interesting because almost everybody I've talked to on this podcast has started out as either a performer or a director or something in that case, and they've made that bridge into storytelling. It's not often that I get someone who is just a default storyteller that translates it to scripts. I'm actually kind of interested in many of these. Actually, I know you're not supposed to judge books by their cover, but a lot of these look really funny. It also looks like I'm seeing dark comedy come up a lot. So is that kind of your wheelhouse, or do you tend to kind of jump around in terms of genre and theme?
Well, I've always had kind of like a Seinfeld Jewish sense of humor, but I never really explored it in my writing too much until I started attempting my early drafts of my novel. And my novel, which is really inspired by my own life, just as the play is, started as memoir. And it really didn't feel like it was going anywhere. At least, you know, I felt kind of uncomfortable being the star of my own story. So I really pushed it in terms of drama and humor. I had the characters do things that they, you know, the real people in my life never did. And I stretched the events well past their actual happenings. And out of that, I got a big rise out of people. You know, you kind of, as a writer, you go with what works, what affects people the most,
right,
and you use
right.
that as a guidepost. So I said, okay, let me push this further. And comedy, you know, is hard, as, you know, as the cliche goes, because you're not just...
Dying is easy. Comedy is hard.
Yeah, you got to, you know, still tell a story. You have to still have depth. And you and oftentimes the humor will work against that because it's just for the sake of a joke. So you kind of have to figure out which jokes speak to truths or reveal character. And you can get away with a couple of gratuitous humor here and there, but for the most part, you really want to deepen what you're working on. And that was the big challenge with this play, Opposite of Everything. And yeah, humor overall is really what I love to do. I find it to be fun when it works correctly.
You know, it's funny you say, you mentioned Seinfeld, the Seinfeld Jewish style. I am not Jewish, but I definitely identify with that style of humor. That's definitely up my alley. I love any kind of twisted or distorted or dark type of comedy done well, which this very much is. It seems like your style is. I've definitely encountered shows, films, plays where there's one I read or started to read. I was offered a while ago, and it was one of those things where it was just the C word and the F word every couple words for no other context other than let's shock the audience with these words. And I think that I have no problem with language or no problem. I'm not a prude in any way, shape, or form, but you know, it was there was no depth to it. It was just that, and it was actually the character had Tourette's is what it was. So every right. couple lines would pop up and say, "Oh, fuck, cut," and I'm like, this isn't for me. I've seen hilarious use of that word, but in you know in a proper context.
Thank you for having me.
Right, right, definitely. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I've always written as long as I can remember. I wrote my first poem in kindergarten. I was a journalist for many years at Associated Press in New York City. But I had the opportunity a while back.
Well, before
to,
we go any further,
focus on my creative
this is,
writing.
This is the direction we've and, been going anyway.
I had my first novel out, my only novel
kind of set
out
up the basic
about
premise
4 years
of
Lumps
ago. And all.
And it actually provided the source material
give us
for
a little
this
bit
play.
Of context of the scene we're about to listen to.
Yeah, and it was an interesting exercise for me, basically going back into the novel and trying to figure out which part of it would work as a play and then translating a lot of it to dialogue. And I, yes, it's got the same title and it's on Amazon. And the I like the stretching into different formats generally. I've written lots of essays. I actually had an essay in the New York Times in the Modern Love section, which went into the exact same events that I do depict in the play. So that was so I like stretching. I went from novel to essay and now to play. And every time I get into a new format, I discover something else about the writing. And it's a lot of work because you need to be aware, like, you know, dialogue does a lot more things in a play than in a novel. You can't really have too much narrative. So,
And can you just set up the scene we're about to listen to?
Well, I've always had kind of like a Seinfeld Jewish sense of humor, but I never really explored it in my writing too much until I started attempting my early drafts of my novel. And my novel, which is really inspired by my own life, just as the play is, started as memoir. And it really didn't feel like it was going anywhere. At least, you know, I felt kind of uncomfortable being the star of my own story. So I really pushed it in terms of drama and humor. I had the characters do things that they, you know, the real people in my life never did. And I stretched the events well past their actual happenings. And out of that, I got a big rise out of people. You know, you kind of, as a writer, you go with what works, what affects people the most, and you use that as a guidepost. So I said, okay, let me push this further. And comedy, you know, is hard, as, you know, as the cliche goes, because you're not just having, you got to, you know, still tell a story. You have to still have depth. And you and oftentimes the humor will work against that, because it's just for the sake of a joke. So you kind of have to figure out which jokes speak to truth or reveal character. And you can get away with a couple of gratuitous work here and there, but for the most part, you really want to deepen what you're working on. And that was the big challenge with this play, Opposite of Everything.
Have you ever been convicted
humor overall is really...
In the past 12 months, have you had sex with a man who has had sex with another man in the past 5 years? Jeez, I'm basically shooting my semen into a freezer. All these questions, you think I was signing over my firstborn child.
Daniel, por favor, we need to preserve your sperm so that one day we can bring a baby into this world. It's much more complicated than signing over your firstborn child.
I would hope so. My fingers are killing me from just signing my name. And each time I make a deposit, they're talking $475. Are they building a mansion in Siberia? Why can't I just store semen in our freezer? We have plenty of ice cube trays.
We've been over this. What if we have a party and someone chooses the wrong ice cube?
You're right, bad idea. Especially with all the margaritas I plan to make in Mexico.
Stop with your joking already.
I can still dream, can I?
Steve enters waiting room, holding motorcycle helmet in one hand, poorly wrapped gift in the other.
Well, if it isn't...
I hope I didn't miss anything. You guys start yet?
Do we look like we started?
Thank God, no. It took me a while getting up here. 3 elevators! Still can't believe this clinic is in the Empire State Building. You know, I did some electrical work here a few years back.
Tallest erection in New York City.
A good omen.
Well, it hasn't changed a bit. No way right. I wanted to miss seeing you two off before the big moment. Are you excited or what?
Career sandbagged. Future highly uncertain. Yeah, I'm bursting at the seams with joy.
Enough moping. Focus on the 8-ball. You need all the help you can get. I mean, these places have really low success rates.
What do you mean?
When we rewired the communication systems 2 years ago, I read through every brochure they had. Insemination works only like 40% of the time, which is why I brought you, ta-da, a going-away present. A staying-at-home present? To give your little guys the royal treatment.
My little guys.
Steve hands Daniel the poorly wrapped gift.
You are so sweet, Steve.
Go ahead, open it. It can't hurt, and maybe it can help.
Daniel unwraps gift. It's a complicated container with a tube like a crazy straw on top. There's stenciled lettering across the front, good to the last drop.
What the hell is this? Figured as long as you're staying north of the border, you need a decent sperm receptacle to improve your chances. I even stenciled a cool message.
Good to the last drop. Isn't that the old slogan for the Maxwell House coffee?
Damn straight. Got it off my mother's Passover Haggadah, which was proudly sponsored by Maxwell House. And no worries about this container surviving the experience. It's the shatterproof casing of a Transflex communications converter. Can withstand up to 1,600 volts.
What am I, the Incredible Hulk?
You never know, big guy. Maybe you're a mini-me Hulk.
Thanks.
You're welcome. It's not every day you get to ejaculate into a Bell Atlantic equipment working for the phone company. Does come with perks. That reminds me, did I ever tell you about the time I accidentally cut communications to Lower Manhattan when I was shaving?
Please stop talking now.
Right. Oh, take this.
He hands Daniel a flashlight.
This Bell Atlantic flashlight has like 10 settings. I mean, so you can set the mood. I snatched it from the truck when the boss wasn't looking.
How thoughtful.
Well, if there's any way, you know, other way I can help you two lovebirds.
Nope, there's not.
Daniel Plotnick?
Do they have to call my name so loudly?
Everyone here is doing the same thing.
It's like I'm in a beauty contest and the audience is all nuns. Or rabbis. This actually happened to me once. Must have been like third grade.
Just imagine, everyone in the audience is naked. That should relax you.
Daniel Plotnick?
Want me to walk you to the front? I can walk you to the front if you want. Well, I guess I'll mosey along. Leave you two lovebirds. Gotta go 10 bar, you know?
Steve walks them to the receptionist's desk anyway. Daniel hands the receptionist the sheath of forms.
Last ejaculate? Last time you ejaculated?
I don't know. Tuesday.
Ignore that person.
No.
Monday.
No, it was Wednesday.
Wednesday. And which of you, may I ask, is Mr. Plotnick?
Sonia lovingly takes Daniel's arm.
Can't you tell?
You never know nowadays. Make your deposit in here.
Thanks, but I brought my own.
No one ever brings their own. The receptacle has to be sterilized.
I already sterilized it with a Bell Atlantic Ultra Stream Cleaner. So he definitely won't be needing your puny little receptacle.
Who the heck are you?
Just ignore him. Eventually he goes away.
I can take a hint. I've done my part, guys. Now the rest is up to you. May the Force be with you.
Indeed it is, Luke Skywalker.
They do a combination of fist bump and Star Wars salute. Steve exits.
That crazy container you're using.
You don't want to know.
Does it, like, shorten the time it takes?
Takes to do what?
To make your deposit.
What kind of question is that?
Never mind. Just remember this. After you fill your sperm receptacle, don't tarry.
Who is this Terry?
Terry. Once you spew out your sample, don't delay. Report back to me on the double. Your sperm needs to be lowered to freezing within 10 minutes. Follow me.
Receptionist leads them to the door.
Welcome to the deposit closet. This is where all the magic happens.
Receptionist unlocks door. Not much larger than a janitor closet. The room barely fits a worn leather recliner, a small table stacked with pornography magazines, and a box of tissues. Receptionist folds a white sheet over the chair.
Don't tarry, or I'm gonna bust down the door and get what I need. Just kidding.
She shuts door, leaving Daniel and Sonia alone.
Is she for real?
He looks at a magazine. Sonia grabs it away.
Hey, I'm supposed to read those.
If that's what you think, I'm waiting outside.
No, definitely stay. Please. I can't face this transflex communications converter alone.
Good point.
So you'll stay?
Okay.
It's just, this technology is really sketchy. I mean, who's to say my specimens will even keep? We're talking maybe years in a freezer. What if a power outage melts all my ice cubes? And all that investment down the drain.
I'm sure they have a backup generator.
What if that fails? I mean, this could be my last shot at carrying on. What if, you know, I go kaput and there's no one left to carry on the Plotnick name?
Don't be so dark.
The odds of artificial insemination working is even less than my own.
We need to boost those odds for both of you.
Right. But how?
Let's just do it.
Do what?
You know, make a baby.
Isn't that why we're here, Sonia?
No, I mean here, now, in the natural way, before chemo starts.
Huh?
You know what I'm saying, Daniel Plotnick.
I do?
Think of our baby. Imagine if she never hears the sea lions bark in Prospect Park, or eats bok choy in Chinatown, sancocho in Bogota. She never dances salsa in her PJs waiting for the school bus, never meets my family in Colombia, and never knows we are her parents. Because she will have no life herself. Because she, mi amor, will never have existed.
Sonia snatches sperm container from Daniel and tosses it.
You have to understand, Sonia, I'm going to be on chemo 3 months from now. Bald, nauseous, tired, possibly puking like all the time. I'll be in no shape to run after a kid with a leaky diaper.
Am I talking to the same guy who was ready to report 3 stories a day while living in a foreign country while on chemo?
Yeah.
See? You're the Incredible Hulk. You can do anything. You just have to want it badly enough.
She unbuttons a few buttons on her shirt.
see anything you want?
No, absolutely not. I'm not gonna...
Absolutamente, sí.
She kisses him hard.
We can't do it in a sperm bank. It's probably illegal or something.
I don't see any signs saying intercourse is prohibited. And look on the bright side. We can tarry as long as we want.
She pushes him against chair and straddles him.
Doesn't get any more no than this.
She undoes another button, kisses him passionately, and switches off the light. Darkness.
No. I said no. Well, maybe. Yes?
There's a knocking.
You guys in there? Sorry to interrupt and all. Christ, you're loud. But I need my mood flashlight back. My boss saw it's missing from the truck.
Knocking grows persistent.
Sorry. This room is taken.
Let me in. My boss is gonna fire me. Oh, hi.
What the heck are you doing in there? You're trespassing. Wow, what are they doing in there?
Could it be my Transflex communications converter?
Yes. Yes. Yes!
Just like I thought.
Wow, you have any more of those Transflex whatevers?
End of scene 3.
And we're back. So, yeah, that definitely gives the tone of what this play is. Well, first things first, I just want to say what really spoke to me about this play is the kind of contrast and pairing of the new life forming with his child versus his uncertainty about his life. Uncertainty isn't the right word, because there's very few moments where I remember him kind of openly accepting the severity of his condition. Just to kind of bring it down for a moment, this play really, really spoke to me because of how a very, very close person in my life, who I'm sure is listening to this right now, just battled for a year with breast cancer. So I, you know, remember her spirit not ever breaking. There was, you know, there was a little, there was definitely uncertainty and there was definitely, you know, pain. But I always remember whenever I would talk to her, you know, just that sense of self was never gone. And that's what I think you've really captured here. So other than your own personal experience, which you already talked about, what was your driving force to tell this story, be it in novel form or in play form?
Well, there's the overriding metaphor. I mean, there are the larger themes, obviously, of you know, wanting to continue life even if your life veers off course so severely that you don't know what end is up, and finding the strength in yourself to face your own mortality as opposed to running away from it, and discovering new life outside of yourself. And that is the anchor that eventually keeps him you know, from getting tossed in the storm that's all around him, that he finally is into his child and the next generation, and it kind of takes him away from his own battle. And metaphorically, I felt I was handed all this great material, and I feel lucky in a sense that I had cancer, because, you know, how it just fell in my lap. I actually went through this with my wife. She was undergoing morning sickness at the same time that I was suffering from chemotherapy, and I was losing my hair, and she was gaining hair in new places. We were both throwing up, and
that was one of my favorite lines, by the way, when they're in the bathroom together and they address the comparative changes in their bodies.
Yeah, and it's a way to talk about relationship. You know, like how do you present the interactions of two people who are close but apart, they're in conflict but they want to be together, and they do it through their cancer, and, you know, because kind of these opposing that represent who they are, so they could banter, they could have conflict, and within the metaphor created a format for that, and also an opportunity for me to try to be funny. So never want to miss that.
Well, what I really liked about them, and I'm glad you said that this was based on a personal experience, because even if you had not said that, you know, I would have wondered, because the interaction with the characters and the dialogue and the struggles, they are funny. They are definitely a little bit, you know, you can tell there's some exaggeration there, it being a play, but it was very believable. I didn't feel like I was, you know, I didn't feel like I was in a farce where the situation was so unrealistic and everyone is responding to it in an over the top way. It felt very real, and it felt very personal. And again, this is
that's great to hear, because that's kind of my background fear.
Fear not.
You gotta have real life reactions to things. The reactions have to, be highly relatable to an audience, and you just can't brush things off. So you know, when she says to him at one point in the play, are you trying to make me feel better? You know, and he says, believe me, I'm in no mood to try to make you feel better.
That is something I feel like only someone who has felt that emotion could have come up with.
Right.
Because we've all felt that at some point, whether it's a spouse or a friend or whatever. That's one of those lines that like really stuck with me. I was like, this is like, I saw the Larry David coming through in that. Well, the another thing I want to talk about, so there's a very, very, you know, obviously there's a real and complex and challenged relationship with Daniel and Sonia, but the character that stuck out to me the most, that was the most fun to hear, was Steve. Every time Steve came in, I have to ask, is Steve real?
He is based on a friend of mine, and I'm still friends with him, whose name is actually David, so I had to change his name so it wouldn't be confusing. And he worked for Bell Atlantic. He was a buddy of mine, and I was the intellectual. I was a journalist, and we'd get together after work, and he'd give me some of his street wisdom. He is an actual person, although, of course, for the play and my novel, I played it off the laughs, and occasionally I've actually run my pieces past him, just in case he felt the character, you know, for more technical aspects, you know, like what does a phone repairman do, or, you know, would this be something a bartender would make, or, because he actually, there is a scene in the play where he has a singed goatee because Steve, as a bartender, had been blowing out mouthfuls of 151 liquor into a lighted match, so creating this kind of torch coming out of his mouth as a way to entertain customers and make a lot of tips. He actually did that, and I was in the bar when he did that. I was like incredulous. I said, "You're risking so much," and I was like, "I mean, I thought it was, you know, really stood out in my mind." And
yeah, and what really stood out to me with Steve, and this is not to imply that he doesn't have serious moments. He has several, especially towards the end of the piece, he has several actually very grounded, very heartfelt moments in kind of a slap to reality manner. But if this speaks to my sense of humor anymore, I grew up on a lot of Simpsons and Futurama, so that kind of shaped my sense of humor. And I also listen to every episode of commentary that they have available for either of those shows. And there's a comment that I've heard from two different writers on one from The Simpsons, one from Futurama, or it may have been the same one just because Matt Groening shares a lot of his staff. And they've said that Homer and Bender are your best asset when the story is not necessarily about them, because almost anything they say can be a joke. And it's, I think that really rings true with a lot of what Steve brings to, especially the early part of the story, because to set it up, you know, the cancer, the confusion about, or the uncertainty about the job, the uncertainty about the relationship. I think if you pull Steve out, you run the risk of writing a straight up drama. And I think he definitely, he helps in those moments, where Daniel and Sonia no longer feel like making a joke. You have him as the ringer to come in and help with that humor. And I think that's it.
He really, you know, he saved my life as a playwright, because I think without him, the play would just feel so overly dramatic, you know?
And right, right.
My challenge with him, was to make him more than just comic relief.
Yeah, and you succeed, if just so you don't think that challenge was in vain. He's definitely the kind of character that you found, I think, exactly the right point to spring that reveal, because it, as an audience member, I think the goal of, I mean, I don't want to assume, but it seems like the goal of Steve is to make the audience think that he is just there for comic relief and to help ease those moments along, so that when that line gets crossed and when the serious moment comes in, it feels justified.
Yes. Yeah. And I struggled with this, because at some point I said to myself, wow, I should give Steve a narrative arc as well. Shouldn't he be going through something? And I tried that, and in early versions of it, and I ran by some people, and they didn't think it worked. And I think his narrative arc, he's kind of the, like a Jiminy Cricket type of character in this play, or a,
He's a mix between Jiminy Cricket and Kramer.
Yeah, right.
I think it's probably the best, that's what I took from him. I don't know if that's what I'm supposed to take from him, but that's
yeah, well, he is self-deprecating. He doesn't know it. So you get this kind of irony, this literary irony between what the audience realizes and what Steve is conscious of. And that's, I think, those moments, if you can get literary irony going, then the play just has a lot of momentum. And
right.
And I, you know, I'm still revising the play based in part on the feedback that I received from the elephant reading. I'm still working on the end scene and figuring out where he fits in. So it's still very much a live wire to me, you know, figuring out his part in the play and how he adds to the momentum. So, yeah, he's a fun character. And it's funny, he's developed his own life. He started as a model, modeled after my friend Dave, but he's become very different than Dave.
Well, what's interesting is he, in a way, he almost has a side arc that we, the audience, don't necessarily get to see, because every time he enters a scene, he always brings up whatever he was doing right before he came into that scene. And it helps you... It works for a comedy, because it almost feels like you are watching a very intricately put together model unfolding in front of you with Daniel and Sonia, and then Steve comes in and throws a jigsaw puzzle box at you with half the pieces missing, and you just have to make sense of whatever the hell he just said.
And he makes sense.
He does, and he does. That's the thing, and you have to sit there and be like, I can't believe that this insane character is probably making the most sense of anybody else in the scene right now.
Yeah, and his motivations are good. He's probably more of a likable character, at least in the first half of the play, than Daniel.
Oh, yeah. And that was a little struggle for me, because I was reading for Daniel in our reading, and I understood him, and I definitely felt for his journey. But there were definitely times where I got to a point, and I would think, God willing, if my life tends the way it is going, I probably will not ever have a wife. But if I ever did, and that has more to do with the number of rainbow paraphernalia I own than anything else. But I definitely got a sense of like, well, if I were this person, I probably would not have said that to my wife. But I also don't have cancer, so
right.
It definitely, I didn't feel taken out of his journey when he acted a little bit unlikably. But besides the three main, what I thought was really interesting, because every play I read, I assess the characters and I feel myself in the moment. But even though I'm an actor first, I also look at every play and read every play with a director brain. And what really spoke to me about this one is its producibility. And we've gotten some wonderful, amazing stories before in this program, and I've talked about them with those playwrights on this podcast, that I was fully engrossed in the story and I fully believed the characters, but as a director I would quake in the budget of what it would take to actually bring it to a justifiable life. And what I loved about this is that I got a sense that I could direct this in a black box. I could direct it with a small cast, because what's great is there are a lot of characters like the sperm bank receptionist and the doctor and the, you know, just the nurses at the end, that could possibly be double cast. Did you write those characters with that in mind?
Not at the beginning, but that was suggested to me. You know, someone said, well, there's a lot of characters for a small theater to take this on, and then immediately followed up, but you could double up. And I said, yeah, that's a great idea. I mean, the other fear, and this is great that you're a director, the other concern I have is a lot of scene changes. And I'm just curious, from your director's perspective, how would you deal with that? Would you
honestly, I pictured this in a black box theater with very limited real furniture. And I think that those scene changes could easily be accomplished with, you know, with rehearsal blocks, with chairs, with various limited props. And I think even in our discussion of it, the only scene that we talked about that would present a little bit of a challenge, not even a challenge, the only scene change I think we questioned was the transition to the bar, but even that I didn't see was, you know, undoable. So I think definitely it a space we just did a Fringe production on the third floor of Plays and Players in Philadelphia, and that's a black box space. You can configure it pretty much in any way, shape, or form, and the play we were doing was, you know, albeit a little more stylized than this one, but we were able to accomplish it with some risers, some stools, and a couple chairs. And I think this play definitely speaks to that. I could also see it, if you ever adapted it into like a short film, I could also see, you know, I don't think the budget would be unbearable for the locations.
Do you direct film as well?
I do not. Maybe someday. But I guess my last question about this play is, has this, I know that the novel is available on Amazon, and I might actually want to check that out at some point, because I did enjoy the story of reading the script. I think maybe it might be a little even interesting kind of backwards way of doing it, that I experienced the script version first before going to the novel. But has this play, besides our reading, has this play been presented or workshopped anywhere else?
No, not in a theater setting. It did get it won a competition. When it was a one act in my early versions of it, it had a different name, The Opposite of Everything, and it won this new award, the Scribe Playwriting Competition, the Marcia Croyle Award, and that was awarded to me over the summer.
Oh, wow. Congrats. So,
yeah, thank you. but I would love to, maybe after this podcast, talk to you a little about kicking it into shape a little more and getting it onto the stage in a black box. That would be, to me, there's no greater pleasure as a writer than to hear actors putting their heart into my words and interpreting parts. And, you know, it's the whole richness of collaboration.
Well, and, I mean, I think that's the flaw about most feedback-related experiences when it comes to plays, is that a play is meant to be heard and not read. And I think that that's kind of been an overwhelming comment we've got, that just the ability to hear these words aloud and breathe life into them. And I actually feel that from that perspective is I get more out of the play hearing other people read them and hearing people say them than I do. And in fact, I make it a point, I think I've said this before, I very rarely, if ever, will pre-read a play for this program, because what I like about it is that it's all fresh opinions and it's all fresh feedback that you're getting just from this initial, you know, whatever's in your gut hearing it for the first time. I just think it's I love being a part of everyone.
Well, the reading was amazing. I was, you know, I put it in my headphones and I was listening to it during the day, either in my car or while I was walking around. And every time I heard people laughing in the background, this kind of, I had this kind of mental check mark. Okay, this works. and even, I don't know if it was scattered applause, but there was some sort of, you know, affirmation, especially at the end of the scenes, that made me feel, okay, that's working too. And then there might have been other parts where it seemed kind of flat, you know, when you're hearing something read, and it could be there's no reaction from the actors, as well as because you're listening to it out loud, you really, okay, that conversation could be more conversational, or, well, that point was already made. It feels a little repetitive. Maybe we can expand it. So, yeah, I totally agree. Hearing it out loud, you just can't beat it. That's why I was so, I was so thankful you guys took it on.
We were definitely honored that you chose to go with us. And if you have anything else to send our way, I would love to read more of your work.
Sure. I have a full-length comedic Latino adaptation of A Christmas Carol.
That sounds incredible.
Yeah, it's a message of cultural tolerance and inclusiveness, and it's a comedy. So, and I'm working with a lyricist in New York City who is turning it into a musical, but I'm also putting the straight play version out there. So, yeah, I'd love to. Send
it over. And before we wrap today, I always like to end every episode with some sort of fun question, especially when we didn't have a lot of danger in this week's episode, but especially when the piece is a little heavier in terms of content. But I guess I'm curious. So we talked about Steve earlier and how his kind of Kramer-like Jiminy Cricket spirit kind of lifts us out of some of the darker periods of this play. I guess I'm wondering, if you could put Steve into any other play, which play would you pick? Either just throw him in with the characters or replace a character with Steve?
You mean like a play that's out there in the public domain? Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting. I think I would make him the Ghost of Christmas Present.
I get that from him. I totally get that.
Yeah, and he would be the street version of, you know. And that's actually, I'm saying that because that's what comes to mind, because in my adaptation of A Christmas Carol, I totally redo the ghost. So Dio's just giving me that, you know, putting the bug in my ear. Yeah, he could be a ghost.
I guess, for me, I think maybe I'd swap Horatio from Hamlet out with him. I wonder if Hamlet would be a little more balanced if he was behind him going, hey, dude.
Uh-huh.
What the fuck?
Yeah. I'm never going to read that play the same way now.
All right, that's my new mission. I'm gonna rewrite Hamlet with Dave. Or with Steve. All right, well, David, thank you so much for coming on and chatting with me today.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
As always, for any other playwrights out there, aspiring or otherwise, if you have any piece you're working on that you would like feedback on, please, please, please send it to erpsubmissions@gmail.com. Remember, every story deserves to be heard, so join our elephant herd today. Until next time, I'm Robert Jean Pelleccio, signing off.